This is again Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 18, text 41. Brahmana kshatriya visham shudranam shaparantapu karmani pravibhaktani swabhava prabhavair gunehi. Brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras are distinguished by the qualities born of their own natures in accordance with the material modes, O chastiser of the enemy. So I should go on to the next verse, or two, or three. Actually, we have to go up until text 46, until we get a purport, so I'll do that.
Shamodamastabashaucham kshantirarjavamevacha jnanam vijnanam astikyam brahmakarnam asvabhavacham.
Peacefulness, self-control, austerity, purity, tolerance, honesty, knowledge, wisdom, and religiousness. These are the natural qualities by which the Brahmas work.
Shauryam tejo dhritirdakshyam yudhe chavyabalayanam danam ishvara bhavascha kshatram karnam swabhavajam.
Heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, courage in battle, generosity, and leadership are the natural qualities of work for the kshatriyas.
Krishigaurakshavanidhyam vaishyakarnamaswabhavajam paracharyatmakam karnamashudrasyati swabhavajam.
Farming, cow protection, and business are the natural work for the vaishyas, and for the shudras there are labor and service to others.
Sve sve karnamanya bhirataha samsiddhim labhate naraha svakarnamanirata siddhim yathavindati tatshana.
By following his qualities of work, every man can become perfect. Now please hear from me how this can be done.
Yata pravittir bhutanam yena sarvamidam tatam svakarmanatam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manavah.
By worship of the Lord, who is the source of all beings and who is all pervading, a man can attain perfection through performing his own work. Purport. By His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada.
As stated in the 15th chapter, all living beings are fragmental parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. Thus, the Supreme Lord is the beginning of all living entities. This is confirmed in the Vedanta Sutra, Janmadi Asya Yataha. The Supreme Lord is therefore the beginning of life of every living entity. And it is stated, as stated in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the Supreme Lord by His two energies, His external energy and His internal energy, is all-pervading. Therefore, one should worship the Supreme Lord with His energies. Generally, the Vaishnava devotees worship the Supreme Lord with His internal energy. The external energy is a background. But the Supreme Lord, by the expansion of His plenary portion as Paramatma, is situated everywhere. He is the Supersoul of all demigods, all human beings, all animals, everywhere. One should therefore know that as part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, one has his duty to render service unto the Supreme. Everyone should be engaged in devotional service to the Lord in full Krishna consciousness. That is recommended in this verse. Everyone should think that he is engaged in a particular type of occupation by Rishikesha, the master of the senses. And by the result of the work in which one is engaged, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, should be worshipped. If one thinks always in this way, in full Krishna consciousness, then by the grace of the Lord, he becomes fully aware of everything. That is the perfection of life. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 12:7, Tesham Aham Samuddharta. The Supreme Lord Himself takes charge of delivering such a devotee. That is the highest perfection of life. In whatever occupation one may be engaged, if he serves the Supreme Lord, he will achieve the highest perfection. There's lots to cover here. First of all, in text number 41, it's been pointed out by virtually all the commentators that Brahmana Kshatriya Visham Shudranam Cha. Here we have, obviously, the four classes of the Varnashram system, or at least the Varna system. And Baladev Vidyabhushan, among others, points out that there's a reason that they are separated into 3 plus 1. Throughout the entire Vedic literature, we find many sets or categories of entities that are typified in this way, 3 plus 1. For example, we have the fourfold aims of human life that we discussed yesterday evening. Does anybody remember what those are? Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. Three of them go together in that those three are trigunatmaka. They're trigunya, as Krishna says earlier in the Bhagavad Gita. And then the fourth one is an extra. It's tacked on because it's a transcendental concern. Similarly, here we have the Brahmana, the Kshatriya, and the Vaishyas, and then also the Shudras. The Shudras are added on as an appendix, almost. And many, many, there are many examples of this categorization. I don't know what explains it, but it's regular enough that it's been noticed by scholars and others. So Baladev Vidyabhushan says here that the Kshatriya, the Brahmana, the Kshatriya, and the Vaishyas, they're grouped together into one compound because all of them have one characteristic that they share, and that is that they are Dvija, twice born. The Shudras are not in that category, so they're Shudranam Cha. That's a minor consideration, but according to Baladev Vidyabhushan and also Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he says, Karmani Prabhivaptani Swabhava Prabhavaya Ganehi. Now, Srila Prabhupada spends a lot of energy throughout his books, almost invariably emphasizing the fact that the four varnas are distinguished on what basis? Huh? The qualities and the work. Now here Vishwanath Chakravarti points out that they're actually, you know, these qualities and the quality and the works themselves are typified by what? You'll never guess. He says in this verse the word swabhava means birth. Very interesting. Very interesting thing to consider. Now when we have these troublesome passages, we have to somehow find a way to reconcile them. That's called Mimamsa. It's a traditional exegetical strategy or hermeneutical strategy that is employed traditionally by all acharyas, whether in our school or in other schools of any of the six darshans. One has to find a way in which an apparent contradiction is actually resolved, whether by logic or by referring to a higher authority or by interpreting it as an option. Somehow or other, it has to be resolved. So we should want to do this here because it's a troublesome thing. And Srila Prabhupada makes no mention of it. He gives no purport here. So we're kind of at a sea, as it were. But one thing we can say is that the word here is used swabhava prabhava, and the word prabhava itself is often taken to mean birth or generation, something that causes something to come into being. But it's clearly said here that karmani pravibhaktani means pratakritani, separated, and that's another interesting consideration. The different modes of work that distinguish the different varnas, they are to be segregated. They are to be kept alag-alag. So separate. Because the tendency in the modern, not because, but we can say in light of this, the modern tendency is always towards cultural homogenization. Have we noticed this? Socio-cultural homogenization. That's always the tendency in modern society. We want everything to be unified and one. And we want harmony that exists on the spiritual realm to exist on the material platform as well. You know, Srila Prabhupada often takes issue with this mindset. It's really the same mindset, the simplistic mindset that motivates the Advaitin, particularly the Kevala Advaitins, the Mayavadis. But that's another lecture's topic. So, but it's interesting to see that Pravibhaktani means they're actually kept separate. And the reason they're kept separate is because there are different swabhavas that give rise to the different activities. Sveta-svayadhikare ya nishtha sa guna parikirtita. The 11th canto tells us. Much as this verse that we conclude the section with. Sveta-svayadhikarmani adhirata. So he says, this is Krishna to Uddhava, he says, Sveta-svayadhikare. To be fixed in each in his own adhikar. In his own adhikar is a word that hardly translates into English, but the best word that I can find for it is prerogative. Because prerogative means not only are you authorized to do something, but you're also qualified to do that thing. Sve sve adhikare yanishta, to be fixed in what one is actually qualified to do, and therefore authorized by dint of one's qualification, that is guna. That's quality. That's a quality. Whereas to attempt anything else, or to settle for less than what one is actually qualified to do, that's considered to be a dosha, a flaw. That's an interesting point that we can look up. That's again in the 11th canto. But here the term is used swabhava. Usually throughout the Bhagavad Gita and other places we define this word swabhava how? This is a common word we all know. Swabhava, what does it normally mean? One's own nature, yeah, acquired nature in particular. The intrinsic property of a thing, maybe we can say, I mean, swabhava is actually different than the intrinsic property of a thing. It's more like an acquired nature, but Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur actually says it means birth. Swabhavi no upapatyaiva. Only birth, in fact, he says. An interesting thing to consider. So I don't know how to comment on that, but it's put as place it as an adjective of the next term, which is gunaihi. Gunai means this thing is going on the basis of the qualities, gunas, gunas that we have acquired. So again, if the logic of the system of reincarnation that we learn from the Srimad Bhagavatam is, anybody know the verse I'm thinking of? Karmana daiva netrena jantur dehopapateye. Upapati is the same word. One is placed into a particular birth by Deva. And Deva is both a general term meaning fate or your lot in life. And it's also a specific jargon of the Karma Mimamsa school, which means the retribution, karmic retribution, we might say in a negative sense, or rewards for your merit performed previously in a positive sense. At any rate, it's some unseen or adrishta principle that is operating once you act in a particular manner. When you perform an action, it's like planting a seed. And therefore we have to know our agriculture. We have to know what kind of action is to be done and what kind of action is not to be done. And Krishna has already told us, back at the end of chapter 16, how we determine the distinction between what we should do and what we shouldn't do. Who remembers what that was? By the statements of the Shastra, yeah. I mean, just because they're nice verses, important verses, I should say, I'll read them again. He says, acharati atmana hashreyas. One should behave in such a way as to attain the super excellent benefit of life. tato yati parangatim, by which one can go to the supreme destination. Yashatravidham ustridja vartate kamakarta, if instead we do what we want to do, discarding scriptural injunctions, nasa siddhim avapnoti, we do not get perfection. Nasukham na parambati, we don't, certainly don't get the supreme goal of life, and we don't even become happy. Tasmat, therefore, chastram pramanam te karya karya vivastato. Vyavastha, this is another word that has both a general definition and a specific definition. Generally, the word vyavastha means the arrangement or the decision, the thing that is settled. In legal terms, it means a particular legal decision which is binding. And this term is really part and parcel of the vocabulary, again, of the Purva Mimamsa school, which is concerned entirely with what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. That's the smarta world of rules and regulations. They're not unimportant, we know. Even Srila Rupa Goswami says, Shruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatri Vidhin Vina Aikantiki Harer Bhaktir Utpataiva Kalpate. Even so-called Aikantiki Bhakti, exclusive devotion, so-called exclusive devotion, if it does not sync or harmonize in some way with the injunctions of not only the Vedas, but the corollary literatures, and including the Smriti literatures, Dharma Shastras included, then one has to be very careful, because it will produce a social disruption. Utpat means disturbance. It becomes a nuisance in society. It's an important point to consider, given the regularity with which Srila Prabhupada and predecessor Acharyas quote that verse. Really, the smritis that he's specifying there, the smritis that he's referring to really have to be specified, but at least in my mind it's pretty clear by dint of the fact that our Acharyas regularly quote certain smritis and endorse them as well. So that's another thing to consider. So swabhava means the acquired characteristic that impels us to act in a certain way. When we act in a certain way, it's like planting a seed. And certain seeds, when you plant them, they grow the next day. When I was in, I think it was the first grade, they sent us home with a potato. And they said, put it in a glass of water and make sure that you keep the water full. And lo and behold, when that was done, it started sprouting little things and it became a plant. And then we put it out in the garden and we had potatoes. If we were patient enough to persevere. So, Every seed has its gestation, it has its period of ripening and maturation, and eventually it fructifies into some sort of a plant. That plant grows, it expands, it blossoms, it produces its own fruit of one sort or another. It may or may not be edible, it may or may not be poisonous, it may or may not be tasty, and actions are just like that. We don't know how long it may take. A potato just takes a couple of days before it sprouts. If you plant an avocado seed is this big, a poppy seed is, you need glasses to see it. Some of them fructify after thousands of years, and they become trees like sequoias, giant sequoias in California. They last for 3,000 years. You can see trees that were here when Krishna was on the planet, they say. So action is like that, and we have to be careful. To be conscious, first and foremost, of what we're doing and why. And that's, anyway, remind me and I'll dilate on this principle later, because Prabhupada mentions it in his purport to text number 46. So, swabhava prabha guna. The gunas are born of the gunas that we display in our activities. They're born of the swabhava that we have accumulated over the experience of many lifetimes. And that is what impels us to act in the ways that we act. Rupa Goswami says, he's while discussing these karmic seeds, this analogy that he pursues in the Nectar of Devotion, he says that some of them they produce a certain stain on the consciousness, a stain or an imprint or some sort of a, so there's a subtle trace there which is called vasana or samskara. Samskara literally means, just like in Hindi, iska matlab kya hai Hindi mein, samskarna, when in the editing world, what does it mean? Well, you have an addition, an imprint, so to speak, a printing. First, you know, pela samskara or dvitiya samskara ityadi. So, samskara means the impression that is left on the subtle body, antahakarana. So, those impressions are all accumulating, and the sum total of those impressions are what comprise our sabhava. And then sabhava is what impels us to act in certain ways. It is what leads us, karmana, as a result of our karma, into another particular birth. This is why our acharyas can, on the one hand, say that one is, by his qualities and by his work, properly suited for a particular dharma. And in other places, they will say it's because of birth. The system should work like that. And it's therefore also very rare if a person actually overrides that process by divine grace, because that level of divine grace is actually not seen that much. It's something to consider for those at least who are seeking to become more humble than the blade of grass. So these are some things we can say about text number 41. There's probably a lot more that I could say about it, but I think we'll move on. In text number 42, we begin to analyze in more detail the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the Shudras. Now, text 42 itself is entirely devoted to the Brahmanas. And text number 43 is entirely devoted to the Kshatriyas. Text number 44 is split between the Vaishyas and the Shudras. Why is that? Why do Brahmanas get the first mention and a whole verse? Why do Kshatriyas get second place and again a whole verse? And why do the others have to share the next verse? Any sagacious ideas about this? One answer is that the goal of a progressive human being who is dharmic is to become elevated. And we'll find out in a few minutes, I hope, if we have time. Oh, the clock's been removed now. Useless clock from last night. Anyway, one reason is that we can be elevated by proper activity. The acharyas take great pains to explain in chapters 3 through 5 especially, and throughout the Gita as well, wherever the topic comes up again, that by performing dharma or pious activity that is enjoined, one develops the adhikar, remember that word? The prerogative, the ability and the authorization again to pursue jnana. And that jnana is what elevates us to the platform of higher awareness. Awareness. So without getting ahead of ourselves, the Brahmana is somebody who has done that to a large extent, because the Brahminical qualification, according to these purports or the commentaries, is chiefly the predominance of sattva. So sattva guna. What is the guna of sattva? Please tell me. What is the predominating characteristic of sattva guna, according to Bhagavad Gita? Knowledge and happiness. Knowledge is how we translate the word jnana, but literally the word jnana actually translates more accurately as awareness. Increased awareness. That's called jnana. And the person who is situated in sattva is naturally more aware. He's got more of it to engage. And that's a very consequential fact. And the reason he has more of it is because he's acted in a progressive manner in his past lives. So that's one reason that we might say that Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas were given more attention here. But this is a pattern that we find repeated throughout the Shastras. you know, we've been having discussion on this matter. You know, if you want to begin to talk about how to apply the principles of Varnashram Dharma, then you've got to have some practical, specific, detailed understanding of what to do and what not to do on the basis of either Shastric injunction or precedent. And in many cases, we don't see it there. We don't see very detailed descriptions, even in the 2,000 plus Dharma Shastras that are existing in Sanskrit world. We just don't find very much delineation of these kinds of practical hands-on sort of things. Why is that? It's been described, at least by one of my gurus, Dr. Patrick Oliville of the University of Texas. He's an expert in Dharma Shastra. And he's translated many of them as well as the Upanishads. He says that generally the Dharma Shastra only gives explicit and comprehensive instructions to the Brahmanas, because the social system is such that it's understood the Brahmanas will take responsibility for training up everyone else. But the Brahmanas, they act really only in terms of ideas, practical application, policy decisions, government, laws, all these other aspects of Dharma, these are taken up by the Kshatriyas. So therefore these two are given more importance because their relative importance within society is you know, more consequential, we can say, in this way. They've got to give directions, either practical direction in the terms of laws and enforcement, or they give at least the ideological directions in terms of and inspiration in terms of enlightenment and ideas. So that explains why the Vaishyas and the Shudras are given a less prominence, and why in general we find this pattern that their activities are described much less. So let's look at some of these things. Shama damastava shaucham kshanti rarjavam evacha nanam vignanam astikyam. These are the qualities. So shama means what? Anybody know? I think it was Baladev who says it means antahakaranasya sanyama. That means to take your antahakarana, your subtle body, the mind, intelligence, and false ego, and to subdue that, to discipline that, to keep your mind in order, to keep your intelligence and your ego in, you know, how shall I say this, roped up, you know, put on a leash maybe is a better way to put it. And in fact, several places throughout the Bhagavatam we do find this very example. Just like a bull can be led wherever you want it to go just by a tug on a rope that's tied to a ring in its nose. So in the same way, the mind, the intelligence, and false ego, they have to be reined in. Internally. This is an internal process. It's invisible. You can cheat, but it will not be effective, Prabhupada said. So it's an internal process. And then, therefore, the next thing is dhamma. You have to display to the outside world that this is what's going on inside. And the way you do that is by disciplining also your external senses. You get up early in the morning, you do not go to bars, you do not eat meat, you don't smoke cigarettes, adi adi adi, like this. That's external sensual restraint. What else does he say? The same thing. Then we have tapa. What does tapasya mean, or tapa? Austerity, undergoing difficulty for your body especially, but not only your body, sometimes it's a mental austerity as well. Anybody know where this is described? Else in the Bhagavad Gita, probably it's hard to guess this one, so I'll give it away. Vitaraga bhaya krodha manmayamamu pashita bahavo jnana tapasa. All the acharyas commenting on that verse say from chapter 4. I think, right? I think so. They say that this tapasya, in that case, at least Ramanuja Acharya, he says, it means the austerity of communicating ideas that are elevating to someone who is only interested in prayers. It's not easy to do that. They're not receptive. They may not even be polite. When you go and try to sell a book in foreign countries, at least, even nowadays, I don't know, in India probably, they're getting very close to that point if they're not there yet. You can expect anything to happen. So that's an austerity. But in general, austerity means, as Baladeva Dabhushan put it, Shastriya Kaya Klesha, to accept difficulties for the body if they are enjoined in the Shastra. Again, according to the Mimamsa, well, we're all part of the Mimamsa school, really, because Mimamsa is divided into two sections. There's the prior Mimamsa and the later Mimamsa. Vedanta is called later Mimamsa, and Karmakanda school is called prior Mimamsa. But in both of them, they have to discriminate. And the Karma Mimamsa, or the Purva Mimamsa school, really, they interpret that the Vedas don't really give anything at all, except for injunctions. Do this, don't do that. Any further enlightenment involved is only to cajole you into following the injunction. And we mentioned the other night, there are many ways to interpret Bhagavad Gita, but at the end of the day, Arjuna must fight, one way or the other. No matter how you look at Bhagavad Gita, he's going to fight. That's the idea. So, that's called tapasya, to do what the body may not want to do. And shocham, Baladeva Dabhushan points out, as Prabhupada follows throughout his books, it means, again, both external cleanliness in the terms of taking a bath at least once a day or twice a day, three times a day, depending on the order. And it also means internal cleanliness. You have to clean your subtle body every day. If you don't undergo a process of sadhana that is intended to clean the subtle body, what's going to happen? It's going to be covered like the mirror with dust. If you don't dust your mirror every day, the same thing happens there. So that's shocham. Shanti means to be forgiving, to be tolerant, really is what it means. More tolerant than a tree. This is the goal. And arjava means to be what? I think it's Baladev says it means avaktra, avaktratva, to be not crooked in one's nature. Now, we know from Upadeshamrita, what does Rupa Goswami say among the six things that will allow you to perfect the process of bhakti? Utsaha, nishchaya, dhairya, tat-tat karma pravartana. We've been discussing these things directly or indirectly. Tat-tat karma pravartana. What's the other one? Sorry? Sato vritti. Sangatyagat means to give up mundane association, not just people, but association generally. And a sangha means it's a very wide concept. It encompasses many, many things other than just people. It means the sounds that you hear, it means the things that you touch, the things that you taste, the places that you go, everything. So, to give that up. And then sato vritti is what I want to say. Sato vritti, what does it mean? To adopt the ways of those who are sat, sadhus. In other words, Prabhupada elsewhere translates it to not be duplicit. It's not from Nectar Devotion, but elsewhere Prabhupada translates it to not be duplicit. That's what he means here when he says that this term means, arjava means avaktratva. Vakra means to be crooked, not crooked. You have to be saralasita, as we say, straight, simple. So jnanam, what does jnanam mean? Jnana means the knowledge which you get from Shastra. And Vijnana means the knowledge that you gain through experience. And Prabhupada summarizes those as knowledge and, what does he say here? Wisdom. So Anubhava means, you know, what you've learned through experience. The word Anubhava means experience. And that's confirmed in the Bhagavatam. We hear, Yaswanu Bhavam Akhita Shruti Saranekam. He spoke this Srimad Bhagavatam on the basis of his own personal experience. Whatever we personally experience, that we will be able to effectively communicate because we have the adhikar for that. We have the prerogative to communicate something that we've actually assimilated, that we've actually experienced personally. And that's necessarily going to be a kind of rasa. Preaching is described, I think it's in the Alankar Kaustubha, means to communicate rasa only, because everything is rasa ultimately. That's another matter, so I don't want to get into that. Then the next thing is astikya. What does astikya mean? Astikya.
To believe in God.
To believe in God, very good. That's a general definition. Prabhupada here describes it as religiousness, that will work also. It's tied into the idea of dharma, which is a very evasive and subtle, yet very profound term. Astikya means the person who believes that asti, yes, it exists. In the 11th canto we find a nice verse, hi astiti nastiti bhirartha nishtaha. People in this world, on the atma aparijnana mayo vivada, they argue on the basis of incomplete realizations. In what way? One party says asti, the other party says nasti. It is? No, it isn't. Right? So, kyastiti nastiti bhidartha nishtha, and we're intransigently fixed in our convictions, whether they're partial or not, we don't consider that. And Krishna says if people become too addicted to this process, then they don't realize actually that they've already turned away from me by doing so. So astikya means actually to accept the authority of the Vedas. This is another traditional definition of the word astik. Astik is a class of personality. It's the person who accepts the Vedic authority. And as he said, that basically means to accept God, because if you accept God, then you have to accept what he says. And that's in the Vedas. So as opposed to the astics, we have another class of human beings, so-called human beings, that they're called Gnostics. That's not G-N-O-S-T-I-C, but rather N-A-S-T-I-K-A. It's a homonym. So, Gnostic means the person who denies the authority of the Vedas. For example, the Buddhists, the Jains, the Ajivikas, these are all Gnostic sects. They're not really considered within the fold of Hinduism or Vedic culture, even though they borrow many of, or inherit even, many of the same concepts and terminology. Actually, the Jain literature and the manuscripts, it far surpasses the Vedic literature in terms of numbers only. There's much more stuff out there in the Apapancha languages of the Jains. And interesting stuff too, but not for the Astics, because it generally denies the authority of the Vedas. So, but this accepting the authority of the Vedas, this is a primary qualification of the Brahmana. He must be an Astic. So it's a very, very important thing to consider. We sometimes have a tendency for Shruti Shastra Nindana, also known as Shruti Smriti Nindana, and we mentioned the importance of those classes and literatures earlier. So that's the Brahmana, and then the Kshatriya, Shauryam, he's a hero, means he's got natural bravery. Teja means he's got power, he cannot be worn down. Dhriti, he's tenacious. Daksham, he's also very competent. Yudhe chapya palayanam, he's not afraid of confrontation. He's not going to back down. This is a danam, he's very generous. He gives in charity. Remember what Krishna says? Or actually, he hasn't said it yet, but he will in a few verses. Yajna dana tapa karma pavanani manishina. These things should never, ever be given up. Charity, sacrifice, and austerity, because they purify even the great souls. And then finally, Ishvara Bhava. What does Ishvara Bhava literally mean? In the mood of being the controller, in the mood of being the Lord. So we have to qualify what that means, and Baladev Vidyabhushan does so for us. He says it means prajapalanartham, only for the purpose of protecting the citizens, people. Because nowadays, what's the more common thing that we see among the so-called leaders, government leaders especially? They have some sort of Ishwar Bhav, but it's perverted, and so they exploit instead of protect. So that's the problem. And since we all have these tendencies to one degree or another, we can just at least take note of that. But kshatra pranama subhavajam, these are the duties that are born of the nature that is acquired by those who take birth as kshatriyas, or those who are suited for the kshatriya engagement. Then finally we come to the krishi gorakshi vanijyam. These are the two qualifications mentioned for the Vaishyas, Swabhavajam. Again, all of these are, they're all qualified very deliberately and explicitly here, Swabhavajam. It has to be born of the nature. So, one of them is farming and the other one is cow protection. You really can't have one without the other. Nowadays, the Vaishya types, they also, they go into business. And throughout his books, Prabhupada seems to emphasize that krishi and godakshya are more important, and vanijya is almost an afterthought. Vanijya means business. If there's some extra produce from farming or from the cow protection, then you can do some business. Because nowadays the tendency is to move away from a sustainable natural life based on agriculture and move entirely into this economic paradigm wherein 5% of the world population is trying to exploit more than 50% of the world's resources. And as Devamrita Maharaj recently pointed out in a lecture in Los Angeles, scientists have now concluded that for that paradigm of demographic transition to be replicated worldwide, you would require the additional resources of 5 extra planet Earths. 5. You got any extra Earth planets? It's not going to happen. And so what will happen? The kinds of things that we see happening already. If you live in South America, you cannot freely travel on the street after dark, even if you're in your car. You can at any minute be pulled over by force, your car will be hijacked, and you will be kidnapped, and a ransom note will be sent to your family. All over Latin America. And it will come here, it will come to North America as well, because the system does not work. It's not sustainable. Does anybody remember what we said about this word sustainable last night with reference to dharma? One of the definitions of dharma is dhriyate yasya sa iti dharma. That thing which sustains you, that is called dharma. That's why we call it dharma. It comes from the tridhatu, which means to uphold or to sustain something. So, therefore, agriculture is very much important. It's the financial and even environmental bedrock of the development of a truly human society. So, what do we mean by truly human society? Let's read on. I'll come back to that in a moment. Next line. Paricharyatmakam karma shudrasyati subhavajam. Now the shudras, they have, born of their nature, only one duty, it would seem. And what is that? Paricharya. Paricharya. What does paricharya mean? To run around doing things. Servant. Shudra servant means running around. When I remember once in Dallas, there was one South Indian devotee, he's very smart. So one devotee was in anxiety because he was feeling that he was over-engaged, he couldn't do everything that was expected of him. And he was saying, I what is this? I mean, it's unreasonable the amount that they're asking me to do. And so this devotee told him, reminded him, maybe I should say that, well, servant means running around. Dasa. Sometimes they translate the word dasa as slave. Of course, slave is, that has connotations that are equally artificial, but the idea is that one should not actually shy away from the shudras because they are the most important members of the society in one sense, in at least one sense. What is that? You can't guess what I'm thinking. Huh? The legs, yeah, they act as the legs, but I'm thinking of something a little bit more so, because we are the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. we want to ultimately awaken within our hearts the dormant love of Godhead, which is situated in all of us. It's there. Nitya Siddhasya Krishnasya. So, this is, it's necessary to have an example, as we described a little bit earlier. Unless we have the social example of the servant, how are we going to learn how to become servants? In America, we don't really have servants. That's where I'm from, America. And it puts me at a disadvantage in this way. In other countries, many other countries, India included, we know what a servant is because there's a servant there. It's not adequately described in the Shastra, because the Shastras only give the outline, the framework, as Prabhupada often said himself, I'm giving you the outline, now you develop it. This is what the Shastra does. The real brunt of the responsibility of maintaining and propagating this thing that every generation has to replicate anew, as it were, that rests on the responsibility that is taken up by the gurus, by the brahmanas especially, leaders in general, shreshtas, yad yad acharati shreshtas, sa yad pramanam kurate. Whatever the person who is the most influential in society does, that example is going to be the de facto pramana to which future generations will appeal. So how are we doing? Do you feel like you're a good example? Think about it. So shudras are actually very important, especially because even in Raganuga Bhakti, the Dasya Bhava permeates all sentiment. It permeates ubiquitously, Dasya Bhava. So do not underestimate the importance either of any of the Varnashram Varnas, or, you know, including especially the Shudras. They're actually the most important, because what's on the bottom here is on the top there. This is why Vallabhacharya, for one, can say that the gopis are the highest devotees, because even though by mundane calculation they appear to be women and sinful women, they're actually not so, because they're connected on this highest level. That's very esoteric understanding that we don't need to dilate on. But I will say here that sway sway karmani abhirata, to be not only engaged but to be devoted to your work, abhirata. Some siddhin labhate naraha, a person becomes, a man becomes perfect. Does this mean that women don't become perfect? Throughout the Vedas we find this sexist terminology is ubiquitous, the mindset is like that just by nature. But it means everybody. Swakarnama nirata siddhim. Swakarnama, twice in the Bhagavad Gita Krishna warns us, do not try to do a karma that you're not qualified to do or that you're overqualified for. Do not imitate another's duty. Do your own duty. Swakarma. So, swakarma nirata siddhim yathavindati tatshrinu. How do you attain that? That I'm going to tell you now. Yata pravittir bhutanam yena sarvam idam tatam swakarmana tam avyarshya siddhim vindati manavaha. Now, a moment ago I mentioned what it means to be truly human, and I asked you to bookmark this. There is a word in this verse that tells us what it means to be truly human. Anyone want to guess what that word is? One word. It's the last word. Manava. Humanity is not defined biologically in the Vedas. You may be capable of reproducing with another anatomically correct human being, but that is not what makes you a human being. According to at least Hitopadesh, and really it's a ubiquitous principle that's reiterated throughout the entire body of Vedic literatures, what makes you a qualified human being is that you follow Manu. Manava is a synonym for humanity, which means somebody who is following Manu, either genetically or ethically, scripturally. Either way it works. This is what it means to be a human being. Now, even as a human being, that's fine, but you've got to act like a human being, and that means abhyarcha. You have to worship the Supreme Lord. And how do you worship? Sukarmana. By your own duty. This is the idea here. It's really being stressed very clearly. Now, in his purport, Srila Prabhupada unpacks this. He says, he points out that everybody is coming from the Supreme Lord, Jinva Yasayata, and back in the 7th chapter, Krishna pointed out he's got his internal and external energies. The external energy is a perverted reflection of the internal energy, and therefore the Vaishnavas generally worship the Lord's internal energy, especially in the form of Srimati Radharani, whose appearance day we just celebrated with great elan. So, he is the super soul of all the demigods. That's how even those who choose to ishat apetas, those who have turned away from the Lord and have gone into the karmakanda path only, that's how they can get the results of their activities, even though the supreme Parameshwar or Yajneshwar is Vishnu. Because he's within the hearts of the demigods, he just tells them everything, communicated. They get their results. But actually Krishna says, very strong language he says, what is it? Yajanti avidhi purvakam. They're worshipping me, but against the rules. Now how is it that Krishna says against the rules? Because the rules for worshipping the demigods are given in the Vedas. Not only the Smritis, in the Shruti Mantra. The whole Vedic literature Krishna characterizes as Trigunya. And yet he has the audacity, we might say, if we were karmis, to just diss the entire process as being avidhi purvakam, against the rules. Krishna can say this because he is Yajneshwara. He is himself the source of those rules. Vedana, what is that? Vedaisha Saravairahameva Vedya. This is the logic. Now, Prabhupada finally winds up his purport here on a very practical note. And I will too, because I'm mindful that it's getting a little bit late. Srila Prabhupada directly instructs us here that everyone should think that he is engaged in a particular type of occupation by Hrishikesha, the master of the senses. Because everything is going on in this cosmic manifestation by the arrangement, either directly or indirectly, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And by the result of the work for which one in which one is engaged, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, should be worshipped. If one thinks always in this way, in full Krishna consciousness, then by the grace of the Lord, he becomes fully aware of everything. Remember that word? I told you to bookmark it. Now what he's saying is what Baladeva Vidyabhushan has also stated in his commentary. He says that siddhim in this case, because the word siddhim is being repeated in these verses here, he says, it actually means jnana nishtham, to be solidly fixed in awareness. And that corroborates what I mentioned earlier, that the performance of dharma will elevate you to a position where you can actually accommodate jnana in a healthy way. Before the character has been purified, yesham tvantagatam papam jnanam punyakarmanam te dvandvamoha nirmukta bhajante mandrdhavartaha. Before we become freed from dvandvamoha, dualistic illusions, that result especially from sinful activity, but also even from pious activity if it's relatively godless, it will actually act as an obstacle. We will not be able to come to a higher stage of realization. So one has to be progressive. If one actually engages properly in dharma, then Krishna says that person can sustain a mature commitment to pure devotional service. That person will actually be able to accommodate pure knowledge, and he will be able to maintain that pure knowledge. As opposed to what Chanakya Pandit said, which is that shastra which is not perfectly applied becomes poisonous. It poisons one. So if one thinks always in this way, in full Krishna consciousness, then by the grace of the Lord, he becomes fully aware of everything. Now, couple of other things here. Number one, we should be fully Krishna conscious. There's no reason to assume that just because we're performing our prescribed duties, we cannot or should not be fully Krishna conscious in performing those duties. That's one thing. And then perhaps more relevant to our station in life, Prabhupada points out that this transpires by the grace of the Lord. There's no way we're going to do any of these things except for Krishna's causeless mercy. Because everyone in this age, everything is haywire, everyone is confused, and so many things we know about Kali Yuga. We really require the Lord's mercy. But if we have it, that's the perfection of life. And even more so, if the Lord delivers us in this way, then that's the highest perfection. In whatever occupation one may be engaged, if he serves the Supreme Lord, he will achieve the highest perfection. That's the purport here, as I see it. Yatha dhitam, yatha madhi. So if anybody has any questions or comments, you can discuss and use this. Yeah, please, Manjali.
Right at the beginning, you know, when you're talking about how Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points from how. So I'm just wondering how. The verse, the way Prabhupada is written in, let's see, that,
text 41.
They're distinguished by the qualities born of their own natures in accordance with material knowledge.
Yeah, there's no indication at all of what.
I mean, I can understand the way Prabhupada has translated it. How would it be translated as Vishnu translated it?
Well, if you wanted to take Svabhava literally as birth in terms of this last line of the verse, then you would have to say, in terms of the qualities born of ones, or in terms of the qualities, you know,
that he's born with.
Attendant upon one's birth, yeah, that would probably be the best way to put it. Prabhupada is maybe a little misleading because it gives you the impression that it's produced of one's birth, but it's not actually like that. It's the other way around. So I would say qualities attendant upon birth, if you translate it that way. But it's very significant that Prabhupada chose not to do that. He was very, very careful about this sort of thing. You know, one really has to have a good grasp of the general concept that, you know, it's about, the focus is on guna and karma, not birth. Because at least here in India, I mean, until very recently, this has always been the problem that people assume is based on birth. Is that okay? Yeah, well, different acharyas are going to say different things, and they don't always agree. I mean, here they agree. I think, you know, Baladeva Devbhushan and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, for example, both agree that these six verses form a natural unit, which is why I went all the way to the end like that, and probably why Prabhupada did so as well. But, you know, they often disagree. Sometimes they have different opinions, and Prabhupada says that's okay, just like different lawyers have different legal opinions. It's always been like that. I would say that's probably why you have over 2,000 Dharma Shastras. Because the aim of any one of them is to take these abstract principles and translate them at ground level into practical application, which is very difficult to do, given the fact that material nature is endlessly mutable. Is that okay? Anything else?
What is the meaning of Priti?
Yeah, dhriti, forbearance, you can say. As Prabhupada said, yeah. So let us see what Prabhupada is translating. Determination. I translated it as tenacity. Dhriti. You know, this, the word has been glossed in the commentaries, but I didn't make a note of it. Let me see if I can make this one. Yeah, I didn't have time to get that one, but generally dhriti means for, you know, determination or tenacity. Resolve maybe is another way to do it. It's related to the same root as dhairya and dharma. They all come from tri dhatu. So it has that sense as well. No, that's a different word. That's a different word. This is dhri. D-H-R-I.
And what is the difference between dhriti and sankalpa?
Yeah, well, they're closely related, and in certain contexts I would say that they can be synonymous. Sankalpa meaning resolve to do something. Dhriti is more like the, maybe, I mean, it really depends on the context. That's, you know, Sanskrit is a very ancient language, and it's got thousands of years of history, and each word has therefore accumulated scores of meanings, and in different contexts that, you know, it has different shades and nuances and meanings, so it's really hard to give a one-size, you know, fits-all sort of answer for that sort of thing. But in general, I would say, you know, what the dictionary says, which is that dhriti means determination, tenacity, resolve, that sort of thing. Did you want to ask it?
Yes, Prabhu, if I understand you correctly, you said something like, generally, devotee acts according to guna and karma, and it's rare when there are some exception by divine energy, somebody has to act differently. Is that something that you said?
Well, not exactly. What I meant was that generally the guna and the karma and the jati, or the birth, they're all pretty much in line with each other, so, you know, harmonious and almost synonymous, you could say. And it's very rare that the guna and karma and jati are not all on the same page. In other words, it's very rare, I mean, that a person who's born in a demoniac family, for example, does not have demoniac tendencies. It's very rare. But it does happen, and Prahlad Maharaj is perhaps the best example of that. That's the divine grace of the Lord. It's the same principle of rarity that we find when a university gives an honorary degree, for example. It's not the general norm, and that should be recognized. That should be recognized, and I would assume that because of that principle, you know, the confusion has arisen at all in history that a person is of a given caste just because of his birth only. They're so closely related that it is really hard to distinguish them in that way.
So my question was, why Lord Chaitanya, he broke this, like the rule, like Haridas Thakur was in Muslim, he became Acharya, and this, and
because
Ramananda Roy.
Yeah, exactly, that's a very good question, because it's a fact that in bhakti, whoever somehow or other, whoever has devotion, which is not bound by these sorts of things, it's beyond the paradigm of, you know, it's beyond the three modes, it's beyond karma, it's beyond all those things. If somebody gets divine grace to that degree that he's entirely unsullied, untouched at all, uncontaminated by the modes, by karma, by offensive, by maya, in any sense, you know, that person, you cannot say that person is working under the dictates of these ordinary rules. That person is a liberated soul.
But it seems it's quite frequent in Lord Chaitanya's Leela.
It's frequent in the sense that when the Lord comes, his associates all accompany him. And it's frequent in the sense that that's our concern. And so those are the things that are included in these hagiographies. But if you look at the wider scope of human society and human history, geographically speaking also, it's very, very rare to find. Is that okay? Anything else? Parvati?
I've heard it said also that when the pure devotee descends, also he brings with him his associates.
I'm convinced of that. My god sister Govinda Dasi has a nice word for this. She says, some people are drop-ins.
Are for what?
Drop-ins. It's like when you go to a doctor's office without an appointment, you're called to walk in. So, you know, it seems sensible that, you know, if Prabhupada, you know, what he did was not one man's work. And you know, he in some sense you can say he did depend on his very stalwart disciples. You know, such
it's
as
hard to believe that
Jaitatapa Swami and Tamal Krishna Goswami, others.
Kukripa, Brahmananda,
so many.
Gargamuni,
yeah.
All with very interesting personalities and natures.
Yeah.
And somehow or other, the movement just began and flourished.
How this thing happens, Prabhupada said, there's no question of estimating it in the mundane sense, but it does happen by divine grace, by his divine grace. That's too big a topic. Isn't it? I hope that's
and for
right.
That, we're all sitting here.
Yeah, we're all mercy cases, really.
All drop-in cases.
Well, we're not all necessarily coming with Prabhupada's eternal roadshow, but certainly hope we're going out with it. Okay, it's getting really late now, unless there's anything else I think we should end. Thank you very much. All blessings.